I was asked to teach Bible class, and I was told there'd be different ages in there, of course. So this is called an intergenerational Bible class. You probably didn't know that. It's called intergenerational, which means we have young people and older people, right? I thought of something that we could study that would kind of go with our Soldiers of Christ program that we have on Sunday nights as we study the New Testament and the life of Jesus. So tonight what I would like to do is to take a look at the reliability of the Bible. Are the words inside this book actually from God? Or are they from people? Are the stories and the characters that we read about, are they real? Or are they just part of somebody's imagination long, long time ago and has been passed down through thousands of years? So this evening we're going to take a look at the reliability of the Bible, and I'm hoping that maybe we could cover two objectives. Number one, that our faith is built at the end of the evening. Better faith, bigger faith. And the other is that maybe there's something that you can take away that you can share with someone who doesn't believe in the Bible. And they'll come to you and they'll ask questions. And you can say, well, I know this. All right, so maybe this evening's class will be valuable for that. But first, a story. This is a story of the three-legged chicken. Once there was a guy driving down out west, probably by Belgrade, because that's where this kind of stuff happens. He was driving by Belgrade, going down the highway, and he was driving, and he noticed on the right by his truck was a chicken, keeping up with him. And the chicken had three legs. So he looked down, he was amazed. It was like, this chicken is fast. This chicken is going with me. Then the three-legged chicken started to go even faster. And the truck driver was like, whoa, I got to follow this chicken. This is amazing. A three-legged chicken that can go faster than my truck. So he followed the three-legged chicken all the way over to a farm. The chicken veered off on a dirt road and headed for a farm, and so the truck driver went there. And there was this farm, and on this farm was full of chickens. And it was full of three-legged chickens. And there was a farmer sitting on the porch. So the guy got out of his truck, and he went over to the porch, and he said, excuse me, I followed a three-legged chicken to this place. And the farmer said, oh, yes, we raise three-legged chickens. He said, well, that's amazing. Why do you raise three-legged chickens? And the guy said, well, you have a drumstick and for you and a drumstick for your wife or someone, and now you have three drumsticks, so you can give another drumstick to a friend. It's like, oh, wow, well, how does they taste? And the farmer said, we don't know. We've never caught one. Yes. All right, enough of that story. Three-legged chicken doesn't have anything to do with what we're studying. All right, there are big events that come in the world, right? How many people remember this event when the first human being stepped on the moon? I was 9 years old. I remember this clearly. Happened in August. I was outside playing with some friends. My mom went out the front door and yelled and said, Dan, about ready to step out on the moon. And so I took off. I knew it was going to happen, so I took off, ran into the house to watch this event. Big events happen in the world. But it can't be, there's nothing I don't think that's bigger than the concept of God communicating with us and the events that take place in the Bible. And culminating with that is the New Testament being finished and Jesus Christ coming to earth, born as a human, teaching others, dies on the cross, and is resurrected so that he can save us from our sins. I'd like to go over two ways to study the Bible. One way is better than the other way. The first way is called exegesis. Let the text reveal itself to you. Don't read anything into the text that's not there. Right? That's exegesis. The other way to study the Bible is called eisegesis, coming to the Bible with a biased cultural approach, reading something into the Bible that is not there. For instance, you can read where Paul talks about that women should not speak in the church. Somebody with a cultural bias might look at that and say, well, Paul is against women. What's up with that? And some of them could say, well, that was just cultural. You know, we kind of grew out of that, and women speak all the time. But see, that's the wrong way to look at the Bible. The right way is eisegesis. Let the words speak for themselves and take in what it's saying. All right, is Jesus a myth or a reality? This is an email that I found from Apologetic Press. It takes a little digging. This is what I found. On January 16th, it was kind of a long time ago now, right? 2007. There was a guy who wrote an email to the guys at Apologetic Press, and this is what he said. The real truth is that you or no one else can prove that there ever was a Jesus as described in the New Testament. All you have is blind faith and zero proof. Blind faith has made Christianity believable Jesus nonsense. There is zero proof of a historical Jesus. Why keep lying that there is? Then this is part of a larger article in the Washington Post at one point in time. Also important are the sources we don't have. There are no eyewitnessing accounts of Jesus. All we have are later descriptions of Jesus' life, events of non-eyewitnesses, mostly of whom are obviously biased. So these are skeptics. Yeah, there are skeptics out there, believe me. You go online, you go online, and you'll find a lot of skeptics that don't believe that Jesus was a real person or that Jesus never really existed. So what about the book? It's a pretty big book. It's actually 66 different books written by different authors, different languages, on three different continents. This is where we find deep spiritual stories and important characters. So we have to ask ourselves, is what I read really, really the truth? And is there proof that says that it is the truth? Was there a giant named Goliath? Was there a king named David? Did David really kill Goliath? Did Jesus really die on a cross, and was he really resurrected? Was the tomb really empty? All right. Historians have a way of taking a look at a person to see if that person is actually a historical figure or a document. Is this document an actual historical document? So let's take a look at what a historian would look at. Number one, it's called internal evidence. What does the document say about itself? Does it say it's true, or does it say something that might be a little bit ambiguous? Number two, bibliographical. How many copies do you have? How big are those copies? Do any of those copies go against other copies that you have? Number three, external. External means the outside forces are looking at the document. Are they able to prove that this document is not true? Or are they able to prove that this document is true? All right, let's take a look at the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, we could find archaeological findings, precise, detailed rewriting, all right, and look at the teachings of Jesus. When you're looking at archaeological findings about the Old Testament, all right, there are some that are being found right now, and some that have been found years and years ago. Detailed writing, detailed rewriting, painstaking rewriting of the Old Testament. Think about a time when there was no copy machine and people would write something over and over and over and be extremely serious about the outcome of that writing. Critics used to say there was no evidence of King David. He was just a myth. An ancient stone slab was found in 1944. The stone slab in northern Galilee that references King David and the house of David. Critics used to say there was no evidence of people called the Hittites. Hittites are mentioned some 40 times in the Bible. In 1906, archaeologists found the entire Hittite capital city, the Hittite library, and 10,000 clay tablets of history documenting that the Hittite Empire was real. So for a long time, people didn't think that the Hittite people were real, and even though we read about the Hittites in the Old Testament, they would look at that and say, it's just being made up. These are a made-up group of people, a made-up empire. What proof is there? There is. Yes? What's that? The Hittites. Well, who were they?
Where were they?
The Hittite Empire. I'm just using a glance at a map at one time, and it's gonna fail me. But I would say in modern-day Palestine, probably east into what we call like Iraq, Iran, that kind of thing. Hittite Empire predates a lot of the empires that we know. It's very old, extremely old. All right, looking at some evidence of a picture that's coming up. When you see this picture, I want you to think of these three things: internal evidence, bibliographical evidence, and external evidence. Ready for the picture? All right, who is this?
Lincoln.
How do you know that this is Abraham Lincoln and not Brad Johnson, the manager of the Wawa station on Okeechobee Boulevard? How do you know that? Is there anybody in this room that ever met Abraham Lincoln? Nope. Nobody. But yet, his features, his look is so common to us, we can automatically identify Abraham Lincoln. But what evidence do we have? Do we have internal evidence that Abraham Lincoln was a person and the 16th president of the United States? Is there internal evidence that tells us that? Yeah, sure there is. Right? We probably hard to find anything that refutes that, right? What about bibliographical evidence? Was there anything that was written about Abraham Lincoln? Yes. Is there any document, a famous document, that Abraham Lincoln signed that maybe we know about? What about external evidence? Did people outside of America write about Lincoln? Was there anybody outside of the federal government that opposed Lincoln, was against Lincoln. Yes. All right, so a lot of evidence that this man named Abraham Lincoln was a person, a real person in history. Evidence that he was the 16th president of the United States. Also evidence that he was shot, right? Shot and killed as while he was in a booth watching a play. What about the Old Testament? Even though it is there, there is difficulty with Old Testament bibliographical evidence. And that's because of this. When you're taking a look at the books of the Old Testament, and they were rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, when there was a text that was dirty, got stained, or even got old, what did the people do with that document? They threw it away. So you're not going to find a lot of manuscripts of Isaiah. You'll find them, but not a lot. You're not going to find a lot of manuscripts of the book of Genesis. Because when those documents got old, stained, dirty, they threw the documents away. Of course, why? Because they were holy, right? They were holy documents, and they thought it was better to throw those away, rewrite them, and throw them away. So we don't have a lot of Old Testament manuscripts. They have the Masoretes devised a way to make meticulous copies. They devised an elaborate quality control system. We can be very, very thankful to them. They were able to rewrite the Old Testament over and over and over again. They would have their own schools where someone would grow up to be a scribe and be trained for years to be a scribe. It was told that they could not copy the text like a sentence, and then copy a sentence and look here and copy a sentence. It was told that they would take a letter. How long would that take? All right, so that's how meticulous it was. And then, after they were finished, they had people that would come and read it. And they would edit it. They would check it out to make sure that there wasn't any mistakes. Now, if there was mistakes, they grabbed their whiteout, whited it out, and did it over it, right? No. It was thrown away and had to be rewritten. Isn't that something? People a long time ago took so much time and so much energy to rewrite the Old Testament books. All right, external evidence. That means this is not in the Bible. It's outside of the Bible, looking into the Old Testament. This is called the Assyrian Lemuel. Okay, so you have the Assyrian Empire. Dan referenced it Sunday night, right? List Nadab and the son of Jeroboam beginning his reign over Israel. It says, in the second year of Asa, king of Judah, 1 Kings 15:25. That's where you would find it, in 1 Kings. So you have people that have nothing to do with writing the book of the Bible at all. They're looking at what actually happened, and they're writing about it. Just like a reporter would see an event, write down the actual events. That's what this is. It's a tablet. Somebody wrote down what was happening at that time. This is external evidence. Archaeologists found a piece of stone tablet inscribed with the name Goliath. The time and the place coincided with the story of Goliath from Gath. Dan, I did not know this, Dan told this story, so I'm going to retell it again, all right? So this is one of the great examples of prophecy coming true, and so Dan talked about this, the prophecy of Tyre. In Ezekiel chapter 2, the prophet noted that this prophecy came in the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's reign. Tyre was a Phoenician city on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. It was an important city of trading during the days of David and Solomon. All right, so you have the prophecy. The city was in a state of spiritual decay. God sent a judgment on the city that was going to be destroyed. So, the prophecy was fulfilled. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed some of it, left a lot of rubble. Hundreds of years, about 300 years later, a man named Alexander the Great comes, takes that rubble, and he builds what's called a mole. So it's like a causeway. It's not a bridge. He took that rubble and built it out in the sea to Tyre so he could send his army there, because the city itself was still pretty impenetrable because of the way that it was built with high walls. It was on an island, so it was hard for an army to get there. Alexander the Great, all right, pretty smart guy, pretty smart leader, takes the rubble from the existing city that was from the mainland and built that causeway out to destroy. Amazing that over hundreds of years that prophecy came true. Prophecy came true. Now we come to the New Testament. Can we trust the New Testament? It's a pretty big book. It's actually 27 different books. This is where we find the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Pretty big event in human history. But did it really happen? Go ahead and take a look at Luke chapter 1. Would you go ahead and open up your Bible, Luke chapter 1. And follow these words, Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which we were instructed. All right, so this is the Apostle Luke. What's he saying? He's saying, I'm writing this, Theophilus, so that you know that the words that we see are some things that we heard and we saw and we touched. These things really happened. Notice he uses the word certainty. It wasn't almost. He was certain about what was going to be written in the book of Luke. He was certain that these things happened. Let's take a look at some other ancient stories and documents and books. The Herodotus history. It's a Greek book of history. There's 109 manuscripts. Some people somewhere in some college somewhere are probably studying this, and they got it from 109 manuscripts. Sophocles' plays, 193 manuscripts remain. Another history book, 96. Tacitus' Annals, which military schools still would look at. 33 manuscripts. Aristotle's works, 5. All right, so how many people read Aristotle when they were in school? Tell you, read, yeah. I remember. I remember her paper, yeah. All right, so how many manuscripts are there left? 5. Plato's works, 210. The Iliad, extremely, extremely popular, extremely famous, right? Greek tale, the Iliad. Less than 2,000 manuscripts from that writing. Less than 2,000. And look at the New Testament. Over 23,000 manuscripts exist. Why are there so many manuscripts of the New Testament? And there's people that would take the look at the New Testament and say, I don't believe it, I don't believe in God. But they'll believe in Plato. All right? They'll believe in other ancient writings that we don't have very many manuscripts. And when we have 23,000 manuscripts in the New Testament, why do we have so many? Because it was so important for those people to rewrite the words of the apostles. When Paul sent a letter to the church in Corinth, and somebody stood up and read that letter from Paul to the church in Corinth, what did they do with the letter? They threw it in the garbage. No. They rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. And they sent it and sent it and sent it. The churches that received it rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it and sent it and sent it and sent it and so on. They knew that those words were from the Holy Spirit. They knew those words were important. And those words had to go out into the churches all over. So we have existing 23,000 manuscripts that we know of. That's a lot. That's huge. And extremely, extremely over the top when you think of the other ancient manuscripts. The New Testament beats them hands down, right? All right. Internal evidence test. We already looked at Luke 1 through 4, and Luke is saying, look, the things that we saw, the things that we heard are for real. Go ahead and turn to 2 Peter, if you would. 1:16. 2 Peter 1:16. For we did not follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty. Peter says he's an eyewitness. Do you remember at the beginning of class there was people that said that there wasn't any witnesses? Peter says he was a witness. 1 John 1:1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled concerning the word of life. These people were witnesses that Jesus Christ was a real person, that he is the Son of God because he called himself the Son of God, and he proved himself to be the Son of God. All right, so we have internal evidence. Are they saying that the life of Jesus is true or false? Because remember, you can have internal evidence that something is false, right? So they're saying, no, what we have seen is true. Other people have internal evidence that claims something would be false. Dan Brown wrote the Da Vinci Code. In the front of the book, he said, this is a fictional book, but yet there's so many people took the Da Vinci Code and they believed what Dan Brown wrote. And they made a movie about it with Tom Hanks, right? They made a movie about it. It's not real. The author of the book says this isn't real. That's the internal evidence. What about, you know, the cat in the hat? Are you going to believe that's true? There's a big cat with a hat on and walking around somewhere. No. Winnie the Pooh, you know, one of my favorite characters, Winnie the Pooh and all his friends, Christopher Robin. No. Then we have the bibliographical test, portion of the Gospel of John dating all the way back. This is the oldest manuscript. Part of the Gospel of John goes back to 120 A.D. 120 A.D. So think about the conclusion of the New Testament in the 90s, early 90s A.D., and we have a manuscript from 120 A.D. External evidence, writings outside the Bible. We have writings from people that says that Jesus, yes, there was a man named Jesus, and yes, he said that he was the Son of God. People like Josephus, a Jewish author, a historian, says, yes, there was a man named Jesus. He lived. He died. He said he was the Son of God. Those writings confirm his life. There are writings from outside the Bible that confirm his miracles. Isn't that something? They don't refute his miracles. They say, yep, this guy performed miracles. They confirm where he lived. And they confirm that he died from crucifixion. Then there's archaeological evidence. We know where Jesus was born, Bethlehem. We know where Jesus died. He died in Jerusalem. We have the ossuary of the high priest Caiaphas. We have an inscription about Pontius Pilate. So when you read the New Testament, you read about Pontius Pilate. He was a real person. This picture gets me because it really, to me, it looks like a wild hog or something, right? So, I know. But what this is an ankle bone of this poor man named Yohanan, right? I have no idea what happened, but the Romans crucified him, and part of the spike is curved, so it has. That's what that curve is. Part of the spike is curved for some reason. There are people that refute that Jesus was crucified or that there was such thing as crucifixion, and I'm not sure why they would say that, because there are records of people being crucified, all right? So we know there was crucifixion, and this is a good example and historical evidence of a spike, right? When we think about Jesus hanging on the cross and spikes through him, this is a spike. So from crucifixion, Jesus lays out everything in detail. He doesn't mince his words. He calls himself the Messiah. He gives signs. He performs miracles. He proclaims that his actions fulfill the Old Testament prophecies. There are critics that do not believe in the resurrection of Jesus. They follow the thought of the first century. Sadducees, right? The Sadducees didn't believe that there was a resurrection. And so we have people that don't believe there's a resurrection. Even though Jesus used extremely detailed language and who he was, the mission that he has. What about his resurrection? This is a third theory called the swoon theory. Here's how it goes. It's a theory that suggests that Jesus did not die, but somehow passed or swooned while he was on the cross, and then found a way to escape from the tomb. Right? So you get that picture? So this is what some people want to think. Now, the people that believe in the swoon theory are not denying that Jesus was not a person. They say Jesus was a person. But somehow, he faked his death on the cross and was able to get down, was able to escape from the tomb. Debunking the swoon theory, Jesus had 6-inch spikes driven into his hands and feet. Blood and water came out when pierced. The Roman executioners thought he was dead and did not break his legs. Why didn't they break his legs? Because they thought he was dead. What if he was alive? What if they broke his legs? Yes, at that time they would have. That was their thing they do near the end of someone's crucifixion. They break their legs. So then you can't support yourself. You really can't support yourself with broken legs. But thinking that Jesus was dead already, they did not do that. Part. They did not break his legs. What's that? Pilate confirmed his death before burial. He would not have allowed this error. The stakes were high and public. All right, so you're Pontius Pilate. He would not have allowed whatever the error of a person faking a death on the crucifixion. By the way, there's no record that shows that anybody else faked their death on the cross either. So, yes. Oh, interesting. Thank you, Richard. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Look in Mark 15 in the account that Mark has. Jesus was embalmed in about 75 pounds of spices. And wrapped in bandages, right? 75 pounds. That's the normal way of embalming at that time. Jesus was sealed with a boulder that likely weighed 2,000 pounds or more. Not something that you can easily move. Especially if you just were hanging on a cross and faked your own death and would probably be weak, right? Unless you had help, of course. The resurrection of Jesus Christ sets Christianity apart from any other religion because the resurrection gives us hope. No other world religion can do so. Because he was appointed on a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man he has ordained, he has given assurance of this to all by raising him from the dead. The book of Acts confirms that Jesus rose from the dead. Jesus was buried in a tomb owned by a member of the Sanhedrin, Joseph of Arimathea. So here's a pretty high-ranking official. He takes the body of Jesus and he buries it. A very public official. Important because it means the location of Jesus' tomb was known in Jerusalem. It wasn't a secret. People knew where the tomb was. As a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, Joseph is unlikely to be a Christian invention. No other burial story exists. All real sources confirm that Jesus was buried in the tomb owned by Joseph of Arimathea, and that Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers. All right, so what's this with women followers? This is important. And I'm not sure if I... Hold on, I don't want to say it twice. No, all right. This is important because women in the first century were considered a lower class individual. If a man was in court and testified in court, his testifying was important and valid. If a woman was in court and she testified, it was almost useless, moot, didn't count. The judge was wishy-washy on it. Why? Because that person's a woman. So now we have women saying that Jesus is resurrected because the tomb is empty. Mark's account, think how simple the account is. Contrast this to the Gospel of Peter, which was written in the second half of the second century. All right, so this is what happens. The Gospel of Peter, Book of Apocrypha. It talks about the resurrection of Jesus. Here's how it goes, if I can remember it right. There were many, many people from the town, Pharisees and Sadducees included. Inside the tomb was a cross. The cross, why is there a cross in a tomb? I don't know. All right. Inside the tomb was a cross. The cross came out, came over by the people, and talked. The cross talked. All right? There's something about the Apocrypha writers that wanted to embellish the stories found in the New Testament. So for them, the simple account made in Mark was not good enough. They had to embellish the facts. Now, you find a non-believer reading something like that, what are they going to think? That's unbelievable, isn't it? Right? That's called the Gospel of Peter, written in the first half of the second century. The fact that women's testimony was less trustworthy in the first century society counts in favor of the truthfulness that the tomb was empty. Josephus wrote that a Jewish woman's testimony should not be admitted into a Jewish court of law. The Jewish claim that the disciples stole the body of Jesus shows that the body was missing. All right, so there's nobody that says, no, that body's not missing. That body's right there. There's nobody saying that. And so they're making up a story. Yep, you're right. That body's missing. Well, he was taken away by his followers. His followers knew what was going to happen. Maybe they're tricking us that we want the tomb to be empty. We want to pretend that there's a resurrection. And so they stole the body. Early admission that the tomb was empty comes from opponents of the Christian movement. All right, so the writers in the first and second century that would write about this, they never said that the tomb was not empty. They always would say that the tomb was empty. So after the resurrection, Jesus appears to people. All right, so he appears to people on Sunday morning. He appears to the women. He appeared to Peter. He appeared to some of the disciples on the road to Emmaus. He appeared to the disciples except for Thomas in Luke 24. 1 week later, he appears to the disciples in John chapter 20. And then to the disciples three weeks later after that. Jesus appears to people on a mountain in Galilee. Then he appears to more than 500 people in Galilee. 1 Corinthians 15:7 talks about he appeared to James and all the apostles. Of course, he appears at his ascension before he ascends into heaven. And then he appears to Paul in Acts chapter 9. So to say that there was no witnesses is kind of a false claim. To say that maybe, you know, all these people really just kind of wanted Jesus to be resurrected, so they're just saying that. You can't say that. You can't say all the people that Jesus met wanted Jesus to be resurrected, right? So the takeaways, many more than 500 people saw Jesus after his resurrection. See, 11 or 12 times in about 40 days, he could speak audibly, he could eat, he appeared in flesh and bone, he was able to reason and also instruct with intelligence. So Jesus is resurrected, and he's the same Jesus he was before the resurrection. The fact that Christ lived, is practically universally accepted. A host of hostile witnesses testify to his life. That's the external evidence. Think about that. A host of hostiles, that means people that are not friendly to Christianity, they testify to his life. They say, yes, Jesus existed. The New Testament documents intrinsically detail his life. The honest historian is forced to admit the documentation of his existence. Tacitus writes, the ancient Roman historian documents the execution of Jesus. He writes, in the reign of Tiberius by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. What if those words weren't in the Bible? So Tacitus is taking a man, Pontius Pilate, and saying that he's real. Okay. Early rabbis wrote that Jesus was put to death on Passover Eve. Josephus, we talked about him before, wrote that Pilate condemned Jesus Christ to the cross. He wrote that. So the external evidence is there from people outside of the Bible looking in and saying these are the things that happened in history and it happens to be biblical truth. In 165 A.D., Justin Martyr recorded a Jewish letter that was circulated that the disciples of Jesus stole the body from the tomb. However, all parties, friendly and hostile, agree that the tomb was empty. So those people that are friendly Christianity say, yes, the tomb was empty. Those people that are hostile, they're enemies of Christianity, they say, yes, the tomb was empty. When Peter stood up on the day of Pentecost and preached, the Jewish leaders only had to produce the body of Jesus. All right? So I know when I read about in Acts chapter 2, I in my mind there's this large porch area. The apostles are there. It's crowded. And Peter stands up and he preaches the gospel and people are hearing him. But what if the Sadducees or the Pharisees were able to find the body of Jesus and present it on that day? That would have been tremendous rebuttal against Christianity right there. And they did it. They could have, if Jesus' body was laying somewhere. But they didn't. The apostles knew the truth and boldly preached it in the city of Jerusalem. Thousands of inhabitants of Jerusalem knew it and were converted to Christianity. John Warwick Montgomery wrote, "It passes the bounds of credibility that the early Christians could have manufactured such a tale and preached it among those who might easily have refuted it simply by producing the body of Jesus." The apostles preached that Jesus physically rose from the dead. Wayne Jackson says, while men may die out of religious deceptions, they do not willingly go to their deaths knowing that they are perpetrating a hoax. Have you ever read about what happened to the apostles? All but one perished, died by some kind of execution. All of them. Have you ever read that Paul went through an enormous amount of pain? Shipwrecked 3 times. Whipped. Persecuted. Think about that. Someone might look at Paul and say, this guy's crazy. This guy met a ghost on the road, and now he follows this ghost. This guy must be crazy. Why would a crazy person go through what Paul went through unless he really met Jesus on the road to Damascus and was converted to Christianity, wanted to follow Jesus, wanted to do great works for God, turned his life around, didn't persecute Christians because he was a Christian, and became the author of 13 of the New Testament books. It's amazing, amazing example of the truthfulness of the Bible is take a look at Paul's life. Thank you very much. Good night.